All right, so Genesis, we just started getting into the covenant given to Abram, not yet Abraham, but Abram. This last covenant, the sun goes down, God causes Abram to sleep, so he doesn't participate at all in this covenant. It is 100% God doing it, and to make this clear, Abraham is asleep through the entire thing. God cuts bodies in half, and a flaming torch and a smoking fire pot pass between them. Now we're at chapter 16. So Abram has been going on for a while, and he hasn't yet gotten a child. Remember, God had promised the child and promised all of these blessings through the descendants of Abraham, or excuse me, Abraham, whatever, same person. Chapter 16, this is Sarai as his wife. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. She had a female Egyptian servant whose name was Hagar. And Sarai said to Abram, "Behold now, the Lord has prevented me from the bearing of children. Go unto my servant, that it may be that I shall obtain children by her." And Abram listened to the voice of Sarai. So Abram had lived 10 years in the land of Canaan. Sarai, Abram's wife, took Hagar the Egyptian, her servant, and gave her to Abram, her husband, as a wife. And he went, we'll keep going. And he went into Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, she looked with contempt on her mistress. And Sarai said to Abram, May the wrong done to me be on you. I gave my servant to your embrace, and when she saw that she had conceived, she looked on me with contempt. May the Lord judge between you and me. But Abram said to Sarai, "Behold, your servant is in your power. Do to her as you please." Then Sarai dealt harshly with her, and she fled from her. Okay, so there's a lot going on here, and it is not good. You'll notice one thing that's missing from all of this is that God never once says, "Hey, Abram, that promise that I gave you is only going to be fulfilled if you take a second wife." So a lot of times in the Bible, people will say, well, how can you say that such and such is a sin, you know, like polygamy? How can you say that polygamy is a sin? Look, Abram had multiple wives. He had Sarai, his actual wife, and then he took Hagar as his wife at Sarai's bidding. And they point to other people who have multiple wives in Scripture. And you'll notice here a distinct lack of God telling Abram to do what he did, God telling Hagar to do what she did. So this is Sarai's plan. She is getting older. Abram's getting older. They haven't had a kid. And her idea is, well, God is, I don't know, maybe he's sleeping, or maybe he's away on a journey, or maybe, you know, maybe he's occupied somehow, so I have to take matters into my own hands. And the ends justify the means. This is a terrible line of thinking that many people often employ in many different situations, and this is just a really blatant example of how bad it is and how badly it can backfire. You could preach a whole sermon on this about the idea of, you know, well, sure, God said, thou shalt not do such and such, but this is really for, you know, I shouldn't steal, but if I steal and I give away half of what I steal, then I'm really being charitable. Or, you know, yeah, Robin, well, I would fight in defense of Robin Hood that he would, you know, that story is about overtaxation. Anyways, but they would take that idea of saying, look, I'm doing something good. My goal, the goal is to accomplish something good. Therefore, I can sin along the way. One kind of harsh example of this is abortion is murder. Therefore, we go and firebomb clinics and assassinate the abortion, I don't want to call them doctors, but whatever they're, the abortion practitioners. Yeah, so we break the law by arson and by murder, but it's in pursuit of a higher good. And this is not trusting God. This is a sin, not just in the murder and the arson, but this is a sin in that you're not trusting God. So in this case, this is a sin not just in adultery, because Abram is not supposed to take a second wife, but this is a sin that Abram and Sarai are not trusting God. And I don't know how much, say, Hagar had in this, because she's a servant. She's not, I don't want to say property, but the relationship is different. She's not employed, but kind of between owned and employed. She's more of like a slave servant than, you know, somebody you hire to come in and teach your kids piano lessons or something like that. You've got this weird interaction. Sarai says, "Abram, go with my servant Hagar." Abram and Hagar get together. Hagar looks with contempt looks with contempt on Sarai because God designed relationships and marriage to be two people, and once you start introducing more than two people, you start having envy and jealousy and contempt, and it's not the way God designed the system to work. So naturally, Hagar looks with contempt on her mistress. And then Sarai is mad, says, oh, she looked at me. Ah, I hate that, you know, get rid of her. May the wrong done to me be on you. So she looked at Sarai with contempt. Sarai curses Hagar, curses Abram. So Abram is, let me not take him off the hook here. He knows what he's getting into. He should know better. He's the head of the household. He should say, no, we need to trust God and we need to wait for God's promise, be patient for God's promise. But instead, he kind of comes across here as this bumbling, like, yeah, whatever you say, sure, whatever you say, Sarai. So she curses Abram because of Hagar. Hagar says, go and do whatever you want. You know, that's your servant. Go and do with her as you please. Then Sarai dealt harshly with her, and she fled from her. This is, I think, this gives me a lot of similar feelings to Adam and Eve. And Adam is just being passive to the point of sin, where he needs to put his foot down and say, this is right, this is wrong. No, this isn't going to happen this way. And make decisions as the head of the household here. Whereas, yeah, bad things are happening and he's allowing them to happen. So he can't just throw up his hands and say, well, I was just doing what my wife told me to do. It's like, no, you're responsible for what you've done. So verse 7, the angel of the Lord found her by, so Hagar gets driven away. The angel of the Lord found her by a spring of water in the wilderness, in the spring on the way to Shur. And he said, Hagar, servant of Sarai, where have you come from and where are you going? She said, I'm fleeing from my mistress Sarai. The angel of the Lord said to her, return to your mistress and submit to her. The angel of the Lord also said to her, I will surely multiply your offspring so that they cannot be numbered but for the multitude. And the angel of the Lord said to her, behold, you are pregnant. You shall bear a son. You shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has listened to your affliction. He shall be a wild donkey of a man, his hand against everyone, and everyone's hand against him. And he shall dwell over against all his kinsmen. So this is, we traditionally say that Ishmael is going to be from Ishmael descends the Ishmaelites. This is a term used for the Muslims. Now, Islam doesn't come around until 600, 700 AD, something like that. But we would they trace their lineage back to Ishmael. So we would say that this is, I don't know if you want to look at this as a blessing or a curse. It's a blessing in the sense of your descendant, you will have tons of descendants. But it's a curse on the land that they will constantly be at war and everyone will be at war with them and there will be tons of them. And this is what we see with Islam, is there are many, many, many Muslims in the world and there are many conflicts, there are many wars that have happened and are happening as a result of Islam. This is not to say that somebody who is descended from Ishmael can't become a Christian or anything like that, but this is just to say that the practical reality is that there's a curse as a result of Abram and his sin and Sarai and her sin. They are now, their descendants will be plagued by the descendants of Ishmael. The descendants of Isaac, who will sometimes be called the Jewish people or the Israelites, will be, well, they're both Israelites, or not, they're both Israelites. The descendants of Isaac will be constantly at conflict with the descendants of Ishmael. And this sets us up because of the sin of Abram and the sin of Sarai. Verse 13, so she called the name of the Lord who spoke to her. You are a God of seeing, for she said, truly, here I have been seen, here I have seen him who looks after me. Therefore, the well was called Beer Lahai Roy. It lies between Kadesh and Bered. And Hagar bore Abram a son, and Abram called the name of his son whom Hagar bore Ishmael. Abram was 86 years old when Hagar bore Ishmael to Abram. All right, so Abram finally gets his son. Let's see how that goes. Chapter 17. When Abram was 99 years old, the Lord returned to Abram and said to him, I am God Almighty. Walk before me and be blameless, that I may make my covenant between me and you and may multiply you greatly. Then Abram fell on his face, and God said to him, behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be the father of a multitude of nations. No longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be Abraham, for I have made you the father of a multitude of nations. I'll make you exceedingly fruitful. I will make you into nations, and kings shall come from you. I'll establish my covenant between me and you and your offspring after you throughout their generations for an everlasting covenant, to be God to you and to your offspring after you. And I will give to you and to your offspring and after you the land of your sojournings and the land of Canaan for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. This is another one of these verses that kind of comes up a lot where people say, well, look, the people who live in Israel today, they were eternally granted this particular spot of land. And there is this sort of promise. But if you look at this again and again, the promise is given to the people who will have God as their God. Those are the true descendants of Abraham. Yes, Abraham will have many offspring, but the true offspring of Abraham are always defined by those who have belief in the same God as Abraham. So we cannot say, well, these people who reject Christ, these people who reject God, they were eternally promised this land in the Middle East. They weren't. If they were promised that, they forfeited their birthright by following after false gods, by rejecting the one true God. So any of these promises are ultimately given to the faithful, which would be the Christians in modern day terms. Verse 9, and God said to Abraham, verse 9, and God said to Abraham, as for you, you shall keep my covenant, you and your offspring after you throughout their generations. This is my covenant, which you shall keep between me and you and your offspring after you. Every male among you shall be circumcised. You shall be circumcised in the flesh of your foreskin. It shall be a sign of the covenant between me and you. He who is 8 days old among you shall be circumcised. Every male throughout your generations, whether born in your house or bought with your money from any foreigner who is not of your offspring, both he who is born in your house and he who is bought with your money shall surely be circumcised. So shall my covenant be in your flesh, an everlasting covenant. Any uncircumcised male who is not circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin shall be cut off from his own people. He has broken my covenant. So this is another, previously we had a covenant with Abraham. This is another covenant. Previously I had a covenant with Abraham. Abraham is asleep. Here's a bunch of blessings and promises given to you. Here's another covenant with Abraham. This is a kind of quid pro quo. The descendants, your descendants, they shall perform this ceremony. They shall be a part of the ceremony. And as a result of being part of the ceremony, it's a marking that they are part of the covenant. Now, later on, I'm not sure which epistle it is, it talks about kind of, it's not a one-for-one replacement, but it's basically a replacement of the older covenant. Of this covenant is the covenant of baptism. And in this, the marking is not a visible marking with the water, because, you know, water dries after it's placed on your forehead. But they call it a circumcised heart, which biologically doesn't make sense, but the idea being that a person is faithful. And God continues to mark his people, but not, again, with a physical marking, but with the marking of baptism, with a marking that is eternal and visible by God. Yes? I don't know. And they've got a different, Muslims have a different history of kind of what happened as well. When I was in Egypt, I had one of our tour guides was this Egyptian guy, who's a Muslim. And by their accounting of history, the promise doesn't go through Isaac, the promise goes through Ishmael. So their version of history and their version of the promises and covenants and stuff like that are actually different. Because, you know, Muhammad came around and he corrected the scriptures because, you know, the people corrupted the book that cannot be corrupted. So, and then you've got so many different groups of Muslim at this point now that I'm not really sure there could be differences there. I don't want to say definitively one way or the other. So this is a covenant that God gives. So this is a covenant that's set up that didn't exist before and exists for a while and then is completed by Christ and replaced by a better covenant. There's a lot of limitations to this covenant. It involves physical things that are not, you know, that are difficult and impossible for women. Women aren't, you know, you can't be marked as members of God's covenant. Whereas in baptism, both men and women can be marked in the same way by God's covenant in a more eternal way by the waters of baptism. So this is dealing with a lot of these covenant. I mean, books and books and books have been written about covenants and stuff like that. But this is one that he sets up where the promise continues and the sign And the promise is increased, but the sign is changed. So this is no longer a requirement in our modern day. All right, verse 15. And God said to Abraham, as for Sarai, your wife, you shall not call her Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name. I will bless her, and moreover, I will give you a son by her. I will bless her, and she shall become nations. Kings of people shall come from her. Then Abraham fell on his face and laughed and said to himself, shall a child be born to a man who is 100 years old? Shall Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a child? And Abraham said to God, oh, that Ishmael might live before you. God said, no, but Sarah, your wife, shall bear you a son, and you shall call his name Isaac. I will establish my covenant with him as an everlasting covenant for his offspring after him. As for Ishmael, I have heard you. Behold, I have blessed him and will make him fruitful and multiply him greatly. He shall father 12 princes, and I will make him into a great nation. But I will establish my covenant with Isaac, whom Sarah shall bear with you at this time next year. It's interesting. Is it John? No. John the Baptist's father? Was it Zechariah? Somebody else laughs in the Bible when God gives him a promise, and God curses him? Or am I thinking of Sarah laughing? I think Sarah laughs too. He'll tell Sarah later. And they have an interesting interaction. But it's interesting that Abraham can laugh at God's promise and God doesn't smite him or anything. But then later on, somebody else is questioning God's promises. I think it's the father of John the Baptist. And God, was that it? Yeah, he can't speak until John is born. He writes on a sign, his name will be John, rather than taking on his own name. So it's a similar situation, but God deals with it. The consequences are different. In this case, there don't seem to be any particularly negative consequence. So Abraham is saying, well, I've already got a kid. Take my firstborn son, because remember, this is a patriarchal tradition. The firstborn son is the one who gets the inheritance. In this case, God says, no, I promised you by your wife Sarah this promise. So by your wife Sarah, you're going to get this promise even though you had another kid. Don't worry about him. I'm giving him a blessing, but he's not getting the blessing that I promised to your offspring through Sarah. So Isaac is going to get this blessing. So Isaac becomes the child of promise. Through the lineage of Abraham, through the lineage of Isaac, the big promise, the good stuff, salvation will come. Laughing all the way. Yeah. So when he had finished talking with them, God went up from Abraham. Then Abraham took Ishmael his son and all those born in his house or bought with his money, every male among them in Abraham's house, and he circumcised the flesh of their foreskins on that very day, as God said to him. Abraham was 99 years old when he was circumcised by the flesh of his foreskin, and Ishmael his son was 13 years old when he was circumcised by the flesh of his foreskin. That very day, Abraham and his son Ishmael were circumcised. And all the men of his house, born in the house, and those bought with money of a foreigner, were circumcised with him. And this practice, you'll find out later on in the New Testament, ends up becoming an idol. In the same way, you know the bronze serpent on the pole where God says to look at this bronze serpent and you'll live? And then later on, the people start worshiping this bronze serpent, and Hezekiah comes in and smashes it to pieces. In a similar way, this sign that God gives to his people here in the covenant of circumcision ends up becoming an idol. So in the New Testament, you've got this group of people called the Judaizers who they look to this physical sign and say, because of this sign, I don't have to be faithful. I don't have to follow God's law. I don't have to, you know, praise and worship God in faith. I've got the marking on me. Therefore, I'm in the covenant. And this is another reason that God kind of replaces it with something better. Chapter 18. Then the Lord appeared to him by the oaks of Mamre, and he sat as he sat at the door of his tent in the heat of the day. He lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, three men were standing in front of him. When he saw them, he ran from the tent door to meet them and bowed himself to the earth and said, O Lord, if I have found favor in your sight, do not pass by your servant. Let a little water be brought. Wash your feet and rest yourselves under the tree while I bring a morsel of bread that you may refresh yourselves, and after that you may pass on, since you have come to your servant. So they said, do as you have said. And Abraham went quickly to the tent of Sarah and said, quick, 3 seahs of fine flour, knead it and make cakes. And Abraham ran to the herd and took a calf, tender and good, and gave it to the young man who prepared it quickly. Then he took curds and milk and the calf that he had prepared and set them before them and stood by them under the tree while they ate. It doesn't explicitly make the connection between other times that people like this appear, like on the mountain when Jesus appears with Moses and Elijah. But this is a pattern that God tends to do now and then. And he does refer to him as, O Lord, almost certainly referring to this as God. So he probably recognizes him, or it just looks like, oh yeah, that's God, obviously. But the other two, are they angels? Are the other persons of the Trinity? All right, let's... Verse 9. They said to him, where is Sarah, your wife? And he said, she's in the tent. Then the Lord said, so this is God, I will surely return to you about this time next year, and Sarah, your wife, shall have a son. And Sarah was listening at the tent door behind him. Now, Abraham and Sarah were old, advanced in years. In the way of women had... this is such a phrase. Listen to this phrase. The way of women had ceased to be with Sarah. Okay, I wonder what that means. So, the way of women had ceased to be with... That's not the jealousy. It's talking about her biological ability to have kids and the indicators of that. The way of women had ceased to be with Sarah. So Sarah laughed to herself, saying, after I am worn out, the Lord is old, shall I have pleasure? The Lord said to Abraham, why did Sarah laugh and say, shall I indeed bear a child now that I am old? Is anything too hard for the Lord? At the appointed time, I will return to you about this time next year, and Sarah shall have a son. But Sarah denied it, saying, I did not laugh, for she was afraid. He said, no, but you did laugh. It's almost like a comical back and forth. And again, God doesn't smite her or make her like mute like he does with the father of John the Baptist. It's interesting that these details are all kind of recorded in history forever. It's like, you remember that conversation you had with God and you were laughing at his promises and he said, why did you laugh? And you said you didn't laugh. And of course he's God, so he knows that you laughed. It's almost like it's real people. Verse 16. Then the men set out from there. They looked down towards Sodom, and Abraham went to them to set them on their way. The Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do, seeing that Abraham should surely become a great nation, a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. For I have chosen him that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice, so that the Lord may bring to Abraham what was promised to him. Then the Lord said, because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great and their sin is very grave, I will go down to see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry that has come to me. And if not, I will know. So God has heard about the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah and he wants to see in person. Now, obviously, God can see all this stuff from heaven. But you'll see that this is, again, a pattern that happens in scriptures that God directly interacts with his people on multiple occasions. I mean, he comes down in flesh to save his people, as we see in Christ. And he comes down in flesh, well, not in flesh in the same way, but he comes down to walk among the people in Sodom and Gomorrah. And it's interesting how that plays out. Another thing that's interesting is it keeps talking about these three men, and it just says the Lord says and the Lord is talking. It sounds like he's talking to himself. It doesn't say the Lord, God, and two angels. It could easily say that. So if you want to say this is Trinitarian, I don't know. I'm sure somebody's written about this. Let me actually see. Yeah. So this, the note here says it's probably the Son of God, and two, so the pre-incarnate Christ, and two angels in human form. Okay. Yeah, I'm not going to mess with that. God and two angels is what I've kind of understood about this verse. Obviously if it was God the Father, people would just get immolated by seeing his face. So probably God and two angels. All right. And they don't get names. Who knows? Maybe it's Michael maybe it's Gabriel. And is there any other one that mentioned but Michael? If Michael is Jesus, then it can't be Michael. I don't know. All right, verse 22. So God is kind of talking to himself and saying, should I reveal to Abraham? Because he already knows what he's going to do with Sodom and Gomorrah. He knows how bad these people are. But again, just like he walks in the garden to confront Adam and Eve in their sin, he's doing the same thing. So he wasn't Jesus Christ at this point. He wasn't incarnate as a baby in a manger yet. But this is the same Son of God who walked in the garden. This is the same Son of God who would walk through Jerusalem thousands of years later. This same Son of God walked through the streets of Sodom and Gomorrah to see what kind of people, were on the earth that he would die for. Verse 22, so the men turned from there and went towards Sodom, but Abraham still stood before the Lord. Then Abraham drew near and said, will you indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked? Surely there are 50 righteous within the city. Will you sweep away that place and not spare it for the 50 righteous men who are in it? Far be it from you to do such a thing and put the righteous to death with the wicked so that the righteous fare as the wicked. Far be it from you. You know, may it never be. You think about those Greek phrases. Heaven forbid. Shall not the judge of the earth do what is just? And the Lord said, if I find at Sodom 50 righteous in the city, I will spare the whole place for their sake. So this becomes the bargaining of Abraham. This is where Abraham bargains for the city of Sodom and Gomorrah. And now you notice earlier on, humans tend to take this, well, the ends justify the means. Those are, what's the term? Not civilian casualties. Collateral damage. 50 people dying for the sake of wiping out Sodom and Gomorrah is collateral damage in military terms. But in God, when he's got perfect and infinite justice, Abraham is asking the right questions. He's not putting God to the test. He's holding God accountable to who he is. He says, God, I know who you are. Will you not act out in the way that I know that you are? You are a perfectly just God. Will you not have mercy for the sake of 50 men? God will not punish. I mean, later on, Jesus talks about this in a parable where he talks about a sower sows a field and somebody else comes and sows thorns and weeds among the field. And shall we go out into the field and rip up the weeds, thereby ripping up some of the wheat? And the owner of the field says, no, let them grow up together. Let the wicked people survive for a while and let the good people next to the Christians. And then God will sort them out at the end so not a single Christian is lost in the destruction of the wicked ones. So this is the same God. This is the same mentality that Abraham already understood. So Abraham is bold, but he's humble. He's interceding on behalf of a horrible, evil people, and he's talking to God who could just smite him on the spot. But notice the humility with which he presents his arguments, and notice how he's parroting God's goodness back to him. You are a good God, therefore, will you not act as a good and just God? 50 people, this is the starting bid. Do I hear 45? Verse 27, Abraham answered and said, behold, I have undertaken to speak to the Lord, I who am but dust and ashes. So he's coming bended knee. Suppose 5 of the 50 righteous are lacking. Would you destroy the whole city for a lack of 5? So again, God, you would save the city for 50 people. But if 5 of them aren't even righteous, would you destroy the whole city for the sake of 5 people? This is a great bargaining technique. Suppose 5 of the 50 righteous are lacking. Would you destroy the whole city for the lack of 5? And he said, I will not destroy it if I find 45 then. Again, he spoke to him and said, suppose 40 are found there. He answered, for the sake of 40, I will not do it. Then he said, oh, let not the Lord be angry, and I will speak. Please, don't be angry. Let me speak. Suppose 30 are found there. He answered, I will not do it if I find 30 there. And he said, behold, I have undertaken to speak to the Lord. Suppose 20 are found there. And he answered, for the sake of 20, I will not destroy it. Then he said, oh, let not the Lord be angry, and I will speak again, but this once. Suppose 10 are found there. And he answered, for the sake of 10, I will not destroy it. And the Lord went on his way. When he had finished speaking to Abraham, Abraham returned to his place. And Abraham's greatest error in this was not asking for one, was not asking for the sake of one righteous person in the whole city, would you spare it? And I think that if Abraham had asked that, God would have spared Sodom and Gomorrah. But in his justice, God didn't spare Sodom and Gomorrah because Lot and his family are in Sodom and Gomorrah right now. What was that? Yes. So even though he doesn't spare Sodom and Gomorrah, he still acts out his righteousness. So while Abraham is bargaining for the sake of the entire city, if he had said, you know, for the sake of one righteous man, will you not destroy Sodom and Gomorrah? If God said for the sake of one righteous man, he would have spared the entire city. But there were not 10 righteous men in all Sodom and Gomorrah. Even still, God remained righteous, remained just toward the small righteous remnant. And I'm sure you could draw all sorts of conclusions about, you know, is God going to spare the world on the last day if there are 10 righteous people on the last day? Well, he already said he's going to destroy the world. But in the same way that he saves Lot and his family, he saves the Christians by bringing them home to be in heaven. All right, can we get into this next section in 4 minutes? No. Because a lot of stuff happens. Yeah, next chapter, God destroys Sodom and Gomorrah. Spoiler alert, next chapter you also learn exactly why God is so mad at these people. And I really want to get into a lot of details that people try to misrepresent about Sodom and Gomorrah. As a preview, one of the arguments that I hear is, well, you see, God is angry with these people because they're not charitable and hospitable to outsiders. This is why, because they were a greedy people. And there is a verse that they use to try to indicate that, but we'll get into that next week. Anyways, it is interesting. This is one of my favorite interactions, because beforehand, God is going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. Abraham talks to him, and then afterwards, God is still going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. But I still think that the conversation is extremely important, because in this conversation, Abraham doesn't argue back and forth, or God doesn't argue back and forth with Abraham. Abraham says 45, and God says, no, I've already decided to destroy them. Let those 45, you know, let them die with the rest, and, you know, let God sort them out. You know, that kind of... God doesn't even hesitate, doesn't consider, but like, yeah, I don't know, 45... 40, I don't know, that price is a little bit too steep. But he immediately, after every, what about 10? Immediately God says, for 10, I will not destroy it. There is not a consideration of God will just be unjust a little bit for the sake of accomplishing his goal. The ends never justify the means. God never punishes the righteous for the sake of trying to get the wicked as well. It never happens. And this is God's perfect character. So even though before and after Abraham's bargaining with God, there is no difference in the outcome, I still think it's extremely important to see that this is all about God's love, God's mercy, God's patience, God's more than willingness to instantly say, yes, of course I'm going to be a loving God. And Abraham is also a portrait here for the boldness and the humility, you can have both, that we should have to talk for God. You know, how many times did Abraham say, may the Lord not be angry, but I'll ask him, you know, this other question, may I speak? Understand that when you're praying, you're talking with the most powerful being in all of the universe, in all of everything, in all of existence. But at the same time, you're also talking with your Father who lives in heaven, or who's in heaven, hallowed be his name. He wants to hear your request. God does not get mad at Abraham for this back and forth. In fact, God includes it in the Bible, and I think that it's a good mark for Abraham. Look at his faith, because look at God's response to Abraham's faith here. So if you ever feel like, I don't want to ask God for something, I don't want to make God angry, look at what Abraham did. Use that in his example. If Abraham is that bold, you can be that bold. But Abraham also wasn't, you know, spoiled and demanding as we tend to be. He's like, God, you have to give me all this stuff and make my life easy. But Abraham came on bended knee and honored his God, but asked for a big ask. It's a big ask. All right, let's close with the doxology.